This is KUOW and The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. Happening today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is opening the door to a federal crackdown on legal marijuana, and Washington State is not having it.
They want to go backwards on marijuana. Washington wants to go forward, and the rest of the world's going in our direction. So, no, I don't appreciate them doing this just because they're in trouble in the White House right now.
That's Washington Governor Jay Inslee. In Colorado, where marijuana is also legal, a group of lawmakers put it this way. They actually tweeted this. We will give Jeff Sessions our legal pot when he pries it from our warm, extremely interesting to look at hands. Let's sort all of this out with Washington Post Justice Department correspondent Sari Horowitz. Welcome to KUOW.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So Jeff Sessions is rescinding something called the Cole Memo from the Obama era. What does the Cole Memo say?
Well, exactly. He's rescinding actually four Obama era memos. That these memos discouraged the enforcement of federal marijuana laws in states that had legalized marijuana. And the latest one was the Cole Memo. And what he said today is that marijuana is illegal under federal law and has been since 1970. You know, it's in Schedule One. It's considered the same as heroin and cocaine. Mm-hmm. And so he and his Justice Department briefers with us today basically said, we're not necessarily cracking down on marijuana use, but we're going to leave it up to the U.S. attorneys in each state, the individual U.S. attorneys. It's up to them to prioritize prosecutions. But by rescinding this memo, they're reiterating that under federal law, marijuana is illegal.
Yes, and the U.S. attorney in Western Washington is Annette Hayes. She is an Obama appointee. She has not commented yet today on this new Jeff Sessions move. How much discretion will she and U.S. attorneys have on this?
Well, the Justice Department tells us they'll have a lot of discretion. It'll be up to them to prioritize what is important given violent crime and drug activity in their districts. Now, this move by Sessions is not totally surprising. I think one of your hosts said this earlier. It's not a total surprise. He has been a hardliner on marijuana for a long time.
Yes.
As a senator, and also more recently in speeches across the country, he has spoken out strongly against the use of marijuana and even raised questions about medical marijuana.
Okay, so we're wondering here, of course, in Seattle and Washington State, how is this going to affect the legal marijuana market? It sounds like the first answer is it's up to Obama-appointed U.S. Attorney Annette Hayes in Western Washington, and that's the answer?
Well, you know, marijuana is legal in eight states and the District of Columbia. Those have legalized marijuana. And many more states permit the use of medical marijuana. I guess the short answer to your question is it's unclear what the effect will be, what will happen to those industries with this new memo. You know, there's a belief by some in federal law enforcement that the Attorney General is fine with the ambiguity today and even the confusion. You know, there are a lot of questions at a briefing we had at the Justice Department today, and most of those questions were left unanswered.
Well, confusion, a word you just used, seems like a key word because it's expensive to get into any business. If there were just confusion and hesitation about whether it's going to stay legal to grow, buy, use marijuana, could that affect the marijuana market, even if our local U.S. attorney is friendly to it?
You know, one of the people we interviewed today, the political director of a group called NORML, the National Organization to Reform Marijuana Laws, he said if the Trump administration goes through with a crackdown on states that have legalized marijuana, they'll be taking billions of dollars away from regulated state-sanctioned businesses and putting that money back into the hands of drug cartels. Again, completely unclear at this point how this is going to affect the businesses. You know, a senior Justice Department official told us that it's unclear whether the new directive will or won't lead to more prosecutions because they're putting this in the hands of individual U.S. attorneys.
Well, what are the odds that if Americans are interested in marijuana being legal, what are the odds that Congress actually makes it law instead of expecting the U.S. Attorney General to look the other way and to send a memo directing U.S. attorneys to look the other way?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There's been a lot of response from Congress today. Senator Cory Gardner, the Republican from Colorado, where marijuana is legal, said that although he personally opposed the legalization of marijuana, his state voted otherwise, and that Sessions' move directly contradicts what the Attorney General told him prior to his confirmation, and he has threatened to hold up the nomination of DOJ leaders in response to this. Several other members of Congress are speaking out on this, so that's a good question, whether they take this up as legislation.
Yes, we had a reaction here from the mayor of Seattle. Jenny Durkin said that Seattle police will have nothing to do with the feds on this. She called this, quote, an attack on Seattle, the state of Washington, and a majority of states where the voters have made their voices heard loud and clear. What do you think Sessions gains or thinks he gains from this?
Well, first of all, on your point about the mayor, it's interesting she said that because she actually helped craft the department's previous policy when she was a U.S. attorney. So she knows a lot about the previous policy on this.
Mm-hmm.
Sessions has always felt strongly that the use of marijuana is an evil thing and dangerous. And this is really part of what many people say is part of his continuation of a war on drugs. You know, early in his tenure, he reversed another Obama-era directive, and he instructed prosecutors to pursue the most serious, readily provable charges for drug crimes, even if that triggered stiff mandatory minimum penalties. So what he gains is this is part of an overall agenda item for him, this war on drugs, and he's always felt that marijuana was part of it.
Finally, Sari, someone who might just be seeing this headline or hearing this conversation is thinking, what? Are U.S. Marshals about to raid Seattle pot stores? It sounds like the answer is not that we know of, no.
Not that we know of. We just really don't know what the reaction to this is going to be. It's going to depend upon the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the U.S. attorneys, the U.S. attorney in Colorado, and the leaders of each state where marijuana is legal, what they decide to do in this case. But this is not what this memo has come out with an overall policy, leaving it up to individual U.S. attorneys.
And again, the U.S. attorney in Western Washington, Annette Hayes, is an Obama appointee, and we're waiting to hear from her on this topic. We've been talking about this with Sari Horowitz, who covers the Justice Department at The Washington Post. It's been great having you here explaining this, Sari. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on.
This is The Record on KUOW Seattle, a feature of 2018. Oregonians, some of them, can pump their own gas. Revolutionary. We're going to talk with someone who says, please stop mocking my state of Oregon. Stay tuned. It's a new year, and Oregonians can finally pump their own gas. Some of them. Oregon has been a full-service state for decades now, which is why you pull up to an Oregon pump and get out of your car, and the attendant tells you to get back in, and you think, oh, yeah, right, Oregon. But a new state law lets gas stations in Oregon's rural counties offer a self-service option. And when that news broke this week, the state of Oregon was subjected to mockery, scoffery that my next guest says isn't really fair. Cale Williams, columnist for The Oregonian. Welcome.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. Cale, why has Oregon been full service only?
Well, the law was put in place back in, I believe it was around 1951. Originally, it was billed as a safety measure to keep people from using this highly flammable gasoline and having accidents, convenience, staying in their cars, and that type of thing.
Well, as far as convenience, couldn't you cover that with a full service option so you can go full service or self-service if you're confident about pumping gas?
Sure. And I mean, I think that the law has stayed in place because people have gotten used to it and people like it.
Yeah, they like it. And your new law, just take effect this week, makes an exception for rural gas stations. Is that because they don't want to hire a full-time gas pump attendant for very few customers?
Well, I am not a politics reporter, but from what I understand, this law was put in place because there were some rural gas stations where they did not have an attendant on hand during, you know, the midnight hours. So you would have these people who are running low on gas who would come up to these very rural gas stations, and there'd be no one there to pump their gas. And technically, it would be illegal for them to do so. So what I think this law does is it makes room for people to pump their own gas in situations like those.
Okay. Now, a Medford, Oregon TV station asked their Facebook followers about the new law. Tina writes, "Many people are not capable of knowing how to pump gas and the hazards of not doing it correctly. Besides, I don't want to go to work smelling of gas." And Mike writes, "I've lived in this state all my life and I refuse to pump my own gas. I had to do it once in California while visiting my brother and almost died doing it. This is a service only qualified people should perform. I will literally park at the pump and wait until someone pumps my gas." Kale, why should we not make fun of an entire state for a few Facebook posts?
Well, I think that your question is a little bit tongue-in-cheek,
yes,
just as my column was yesterday.
Yeah.
And so here's what's funny. I actually reached out to Mike yesterday.
Facebook guy? Really?
Indeed. Mike Perrone. And I talked to him. Mike does not have a brother, and Mike has never set foot in Oregon. He wrote the post sarcastically.
What? He had three or 4,000 replies on that string.
Indeed, he did. He was as surprised as I was, and he said he got a ton of messages on Facebook. About 30% of them were kind of like, haha, that was a good joke, and the other 70% were like, wow, you are very incompetent. You can't pump your own gas. But I think that just goes to show, like, in all of these dozens of stories that were written yesterday and the day before, you know, they were all over the place. They all cited the same 4 or 5 Facebook comments that made Oregonians look ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that was what kind of rubbed me the wrong way, especially when, you know, some of them, as we found out from Mike, weren't even real. So, I mean, I think that goes to the bigger question of sourcing for these types of things, and it's easy to pluck a comment out of a Facebook thread. I mean, last I checked, that the Facebook post had something like 43,000 comments or something like that. And when you see the same 4 or 5 constantly cited, it just kind of begs the question of what is everybody else saying and how much faith can you really put in a random Facebook comment under a news story post?
Yes, yes, thank you. I am on a similar mission. Whenever I hear a story pitch that begins with, there's outrage on Twitter or there's such a big reaction on Facebook, I always want to know more because that in itself is not interesting. So how representative do you think Facebook comments? Well, let me put it this way. How do you think most Oregonians actually feel? Do you have any sense of how Oregonians feel? I know there's a lot of Oregonians, but
yeah.
Do you have any sense of public opinion on the gas pumping issue?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer. This would just be my guess, and it is just my guess, so I'll put that caveat in front of it.
Thank you.
But I think it's something that Oregonians like. I mean, I think that pumping gas is not a particularly enjoyable activity.
True.
And if somebody else is going to do it for you, that's great. Now, I can't speak for gas station owners who have to pay these attendants, you know, there are other aspects to consider. There are some economic arguments against forcing people to have someone else pump their gas. But I think by and large, the average Oregon consumer, if you ask them do they like this or not, they would say they do.
What about you?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, I've lived in Oregon for about 2 years, and it certainly struck me as odd when I first came here. I was like, I can do this myself. Why am I waiting for someone else to do it? But, I mean, you know, when it's rainy, when it's cold, when I'm just tired, sometimes it's nice to be able to sit in the car and have someone else do it.
You're not getting a lot of sympathy from anyone who's listening from Boston right now in a foot and a half of snow.
No, I wouldn't imagine that I am,
yeah.
But hopefully they're sitting inside, staying warm and letting their rage at me keep them from getting frostbite.
Don't you ever end up waiting in a line, whereas if you could do it yourself, you could just go do it and be on your way? That's not annoying?
To be honest, that's maybe happened once or twice in the 2 years that I've lived here, and I mean, I used to live in California, and I waited in lines at gas stations there, too. I mean, I don't think that situation is unique to Oregon.
Okay. You get your oil checked? Windshield cleaned?
I have not gotten my oil checked, but I have gotten my tire pressure checked and my windshield cleaned, which almost never happened when I did it myself.
Yeah. Vacuum my upholstery, too, please.
I've never gotten that, but I'll keep my fingers crossed.
You even write in your piece that you think, I don't know if you're joking or not, but you seem to think maybe America is envious of Oregon.
I mean, I don't know. I thought the I And like I said, I'm relatively new to Oregon. I had no idea that this was such a hot button issue. The reaction that I've gotten has been pretty passionate on both sides. And indeed, that was a tongue-in-cheek joke.
Okay.
I don't think by and large the majority of the population has any problem pumping their own gas. and I don't think that it's a huge privilege to have your gas pumped for you. That being said, there's some reason why the rest of the country, maybe it's just for entertainment value or some other reason that I don't know, has decided to take aim at Oregon over this.
Jersey has the same law that Oregon does.
They certainly do.
But a friend of mine who's from New Jersey says that they don't get mocked by New Yorkers and Pennsylvanians because there's so many other things about New Jersey to mock. That it's so far down the list, you'd have to get past toxic waste and Guido's, Jersey Shore, all that stuff. So they don't really get made fun of in New Jersey like Oregon does.
I guess maybe we should just be happy that we have fewer things on the list above our gas pumping tendencies.
Do you think maybe the gas pump thing is being conflated with the Portlandia, the idea that Oregonians are precious? I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've gotten a number of reactions on Twitter saying that calling us snowflakes and whatnot, and mm-hmm. the liberal reputation that Oregon has is, you know, needing to be nannied. I think that certainly comes into play.
Okay. Well, the San Francisco Chronicle's website was one of many similar headlines and stories. The quote was, "Oregonians lose it when they realize they might have to start pumping their own gas." And we hope we've made you a little smarter than that about some of the reaction from Oregon, where columnist Cale Williams likes the full service requirement. By the way, the name Cale, I mean, isn't that also playing into the Portlandia? You know, of course, someone from Oregon. Of course, I would find someone from Oregon named Cale and interview him.
Of course. Well, I'm actually Cale IV. My great-grandfather, Cale I, was born in 1899, far, far preceding the current superfood fad. So I'll just put that on the record to let people know.
You are literally on the record. Cale, good to talk with you. Let's do it again sometime.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The record on KUOW Seattle. That's Cale Williams IV from the Oregonian. And in just a moment, who needs gasoline? What about nitrogen? What about magnets? You're going to learn about the dream of a 15-minute trip from Seattle to Portland just ahead. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. We are going to consider the science of traveling from Portland to Seattle in 15 minutes, and we'll do that in about 15 minutes, actually. How about traveling 240 miles away from Earth and spending an entire year in space? Retired astronaut Scott Kelly knows a lot about that. He was on 4 space flights, including an entire year aboard the International Space Station. His memoir is called Endurance: A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. I talked to him last year about what it's like to spend so much time in space, including why outer space smells like a sparkler on the 4th of July. Metal that's been burned.
I don't know. It just does.
I mean, I understand there's probably hot metal in planets and stuff, but you're so far from anything, I don't get it.
Well, I think it's the smell of the stuff that was exposed to space. It's really not the smell of nothing, right? Nothing have a smell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the outside of the space station that was at vacuum or, you know, exposed to the harsh rays of the sun as a particular smell.
So it smells like metal if you're in metal.
Sure.
You've said that the typical astronaut memoir focuses on the good stuff and not the things the astronaut might not be proud of. How do you want us to see space travel? And will you tell us stuff you're not proud of?
Well, that's why in my book there are some things that you maybe other people have not written in their memoirs because it's not necessarily a positive thing. But I think it's important to tell the whole story, and I wanted to have my story be believable. And I think when you include things that you're not particularly proud of or, you know, stuff that you're not necessarily comfortable talking about, it makes a more believable story.
What would that be?
Well, in my case, you know, a lot of things. I was a bad student growing up as a kid. I couldn't pay attention. I had, you know, parents that didn't get along and argued, and, you know, father was an alcoholic. I had prostate cancer. I mean, these are things that I think some people might choose not to share, personal things mm-hmm. like that.
Well, prostate cancer, I think most of us would imagine that only the super fit are going into space, especially for long periods of time. How did prostate cancer play into that, if at all?
Well, it certainly didn't help me go to space for a long period of time. I wasn't selected because I had cancer, but it's something that happened to me, and it happens to other people, and I was able to, you know, work through it, and with some good medical care and support by my employer, NASA, I was able to continue my job. And I think it's a great lesson that, you know, bad things can happen to people. And, you know, if you, you know, certainly in my case, there was, you know, I was lucky in some respect that it wasn't as bad as it might have been if I would have caught it later. But with some good medical treatment and, you know, an optimistic outlook, you can, you know, continue, do the things that you want to do. And in my case, you know, I flew in space for 20 days in my first two flights, had prostate cancer, and then flew in space for 500 days after. And, you know, I think that's a good
message. What they call a good outcome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You spent 340 days on the International Space Station, the longest any American has ever spent in free fall around our planet. What does that mean?
Yeah, when we're in space, we are going really fast, and we are, you know, affected by Earth's gravity. Earth's gravity allows us to be in what's called free fall, or this ballistic falling trajectory around Earth, and that's why we float in space. We don't float in space because we're away from the Earth. You know, we're almost as affected by the mass and gravity of the Earth as if you're on the planet. It's just a fact that we're going really, really fast, and we're falling around the Earth, and the space station is as well, so everything floats.
You know what? I can't believe I didn't know that.
I can't believe you didn't know it either.
Yeah, yeah, you should be shocked. I thought of it as being far from Earth's gravity. So when you're floating for that reason, does it feel like zero gravity?
Yes.
Yeah.
It feels like you're falling.
Yeah. What's that like to fall for a year?
It takes a little getting used to. But, you know, it doesn't. I say that it feels like you're falling. It feels like really, it really mostly feels like you're floating. You can make it feel like, when I was going to sleep, I could close my eyes and maybe give myself a little bit of a force and velocity in one direction. And I could imagine that I was just falling around the planet, and I could let my mind feel that way for, you know, as long as I wanted, 10, 20 minutes. Some people have reported that on their whole mission on a space shuttle flight that's shorter, they felt like they were falling the whole time. Which can be a little bit, you know, probably a little bit of a distraction.
A little bit. But it sounds kind of womb-like, too, to me, to be, there's some freedom to that.
You know, there is. It's fun, certainly. Floating around is fun, there's no question. But at the same time, it makes most things harder to do because you can't put anything down. Everything has to be secured or you'll lose things or stuff will be flying all over the place. It'll be chaos.
So NASA wanted you up there that long to study what it did to you? Is that about it?
Yeah, so the idea behind Misha, my Russian colleague, and I being in space for almost a year is that we, you know, if we're going to go to Mars someday, which I think we will, I hope we do, we're going to have to understand how the environment affects our human physiology when we're in space for longer periods of time. So that was the premise behind doing this.
And what did it do to you?
Interestingly enough, it had some definitely more negative effects, symptoms than I experienced in my previous flight of 159 days. You know, you lose bone mass and muscle mass, but, you know, those are things you don't necessarily feel. The stuff I felt was, you know, soreness, stiffness, swelling in my legs when I would stand up. My skin reacted to touching anything because I hadn't touched anything for a really long time. So I had like hives and rashes. had flu-like symptoms. I was nauseous for a while. But that's why we're going to space. We want to learn these things. So when we go to Mars someday, the people that get there are prepared to live and work on the surface of the planet.
Was any of that a surprise? Was that did NASA learn from that? Whoa, you're up to space a year and
yes,
and
I hope so. It was a surprise to me. I think it was a surprise to them as well. And you know, we need to learn more about this. I think we're very capable of going to Mars. I think it's more of a a political decision than it is a scientific or engineering problem.
Now, of course, we all get nauseous at some point in the space of a year, or a lot of us do. We get sick and things happen. But you had a unique control group for going into space. You have a twin brother.
Yeah.
Was that a coincidence? How did all that unfold?
It was kind of a serendipitous thing, because I had been assigned to this mission to be the astronaut that was going to spend a year in space, and then I just happened to ask a question in a briefing when I was kind of getting educated on the science program we had prior to talking to the press about the flight. And I just happened to ask a question, hey, do you guys plan on doing anything with my brother and I, any kind of genetic testing? You know, because he's, we're identical twins, and he worked for NASA for 15 years, and NASA has a lot of baseline data on him going back to 1995 when we first interviewed. So I thought, maybe this was a good idea for an experiment opportunity. And the person I asked the question of, the lead scientist at the Johnson Space Center, said, well, we don't have any plans to do that, but if we did, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, if it made sense, sure. And he said, okay. And then
baseline meaning someone to compare your experience.
Yeah, my brother.
He's got your DNA.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I think it had never come up before is apparently it's against the law for the U.S. government to ask their employees to participate in genetic research. You're not even allowed to ask.
Hmm.
And the fact that I had brought it up kind of opened up the door to this as a possibility. So the scientist goes back, the head scientist goes back, talks to his colleagues. They talk to a bunch of researchers, and in fact, there was a lot of interest in doing this, even though it was a very small sample group of one.
Mm-hmm.
But there was still a lot of interest in doing this as a comparative study with my brother and I, mostly in the area of genetics.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what you learned yet?
Yeah, we've learned some things. As an example, my telomeres. You know what telomeres are?
Vaguely from biology class, yeah.
Yeah, so these are the things on the ends of our chromosomes, the length of which are an indicator of our physical age. As we age, they get shorter, more frayed. So the hypothesis was I would be in space for a year, harsh environment, floating around, radiation, stress, what have you. And my telomeres would shorten and go in the direction of me getting older compared to my brother. The reality of it is, and what we found was, it was the opposite. They actually got better compared to his. Once I got back on Earth, they kind of caught up to him again.
Really?
And, which is kind of an interesting experiment when you expect one thing to happen and it's the exact opposite. Now, I don't think this is going to be a fountain of youth, but it is, definitely an area that we need to dig deeper into.
Yeah, it's not a big enough data set, but it's intriguing
that
you didn't age in that way. I'm talking with retired astronaut Scott Kelly, author of the new memoir called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. And we've talked about some physical effects. What about what a year in space did to you mentally, psychically?
Astronauts that have been in space for periods of time, I think probably the longer you've had this privileged experience and view, the more you're affected in this way, I would think. But when you look out at the Earth from space, you see this incredibly beautiful planet. Now, certainly parts of it are covered in pollution all the time, and that's something we need to fix. But
you can see pollution from space?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Certain parts of Asia all the time, almost always covered in pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So, it makes you, I think, more of an environmentalist that, you look at this beautiful place and it makes you want to take care of it more. But then you also have this perspective on humanity from looking out at Earth. You know, you see a planet with no political borders, especially during the day. It looks like, you know, we are all people of, you know, continents or people of the entire planet versus from any particular country. When we would follow the news on board the space station, you know, coming from this very beautiful place, it's almost always bad news. Kind of gives you a sense of, you know, I think it puts you more in touch with humanity, maybe a different sense of empathy for, you know, the people of Earth and the problems we all share, and makes you think, you know, maybe we need to work a little bit better to solve those problems, because we all are all in this experience of life on this planet together.
I've heard that from astronauts before, people who see Earth with that view, and that might be more and more of us eventually space traveling,
oh,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we are on possibly the cusp of a revolution in space travel, like we were in the early parts of the last century with aviation.
Well, today's aviators, space explorers, it's less NASA and more Jeff Bezos-type billionaires. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's great that we have people like Jeff Bezos that feels so passionately about this, that he's willing to invest $1 billion of his own money every year to fund a space program that at some point will make access to space more affordable than it currently is today. And NASA actually even has partnerships with some countries companies like SpaceX and Boeing to take over access to low Earth orbit because, you know, we hope they can do it cheaper. Hopefully it won't be any less safe, and that's something, you know, we're going to have to demonstrate. And then that allows NASA to use any money saved for, you know, exploration beyond low Earth orbit, and also, you know, frees up our resources to focus on that problem, which is, you know, more complicated than, you know, just going into orbit around our planet.
With space becoming more privatized, do you have any concerns about whether we're doing the right things and the wise things versus the profitable and the marketable things?
Well, I think the privatization and the marketability of that will be decided by the companies, you know, whether
right
what they're doing is makes sense from a business case.
Exactly.
Yeah. So NASA doesn't have that issue. But I do think that the potential exists there to, you know, lower the cost of spaceflight and improve access. So, you know, like we were talking about earlier, we can have more and more people share this incredible experience and this orbital perspective on Earth.
Are there lessons you learned that you want the rest of us to come away with as we head into our space future?
I learned a lot on in my year in space in the course of my career at NASA, including my, you know, my other missions. You know, I learned a lot about Earth and the environment, and I think we need to take care of it better than we do. You know, I learned to be a more empathetic person to the human condition. I learned a lot about, you know, how diversity is very important. You know, this is an international partnership. People with different backgrounds, different, you know, come from different educational backgrounds, different personal experiences, different cultures. And I've definitely noticed that is a you know, critically important to having a team that can solve problems in many different ways. So clearly been demonstrated to me, diverse teams are stronger teams. I learned a lot about leadership. I think leadership is very situationally dependent. But the most important thing I've learned, and that is, you know, we built this space station, 1 million pounds, while flying around the Earth at impossible speeds. It's the most complicated thing we have ever done. And if we can do this, we can do anything, you know, if we put our minds to it. You know, if we want to go to Mars, we can do that. Cure cancer, if we put the resources behind it, we can do that. Solve our issues in this country, which I believe there are many. You know, absolutely inspired after spending a year in space that if we can dream it, we can do it.
If we can dream it, we can do it. That is retired U.S. astronaut Scott Kelly. His memoir is called Endurance, A Year in Space, A Lifetime of Discovery. He also wrote a book for kids called My Journey to the Stars. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Space travel, International Space Station, that seemed like a faraway dream at one time, as a trip from Seattle to Portland taking 15 minutes must. We're going to talk about whether a hyperloop from Seattle to Portland, 700 miles per hour, is that feasible in your lifetime and mine? That's coming up. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. With just a few clicks of the keyboard or taps on your phone, you can instantly reach somebody in Portland or Vancouver, just not in person. Sure, you can get on an airplane or in your car, but that takes time, hours sometimes. My next guest wants to cut that trip time down to 15 minutes in the case of Portland. Mitchell Fremote is a junior at the University of Washington studying mechanical engineering. He directs a team of students building a Hyperloop pod. Mitchell, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What is Hyperloop?
So Hyperloop is essentially a form of high-speed transportation where you have, you can call them pods, or essentially small trains that run through a vacuum tube.
How small? Like I'm the only one in my pod, or is it a car?
To make it economical, it'd have to have at least room for a bunch of people. Probably, 10 to 20 would be my guess.
Okay.
But for what we're doing, it's a small-scale pod, so it's going to be fit one person.
All right. Pod shooting through a tunnel.
Yes.
Near supersonic speeds.
Above supersonic.
Above supersonic.
Yeah.
Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes. Is that true? Is that realistic?
If Hyperloop becomes a reality, then yeah, that's what it'll do.
180 miles between here and there. That's about 720 miles an hour.
Yep.
How does that work? How do you get that speed?
You get that speed because when you're in a vacuum tube, you don't have the air resistance. With, say, planes or trains, you have a lot of drag from the air resistance. And when you don't have that, it allows you to achieve a lot higher speeds. And that's about as simple as that.
So you're just being sucked through a vacuum tube?
It's not necessarily, I wouldn't call it sucked. There's different propulsion systems you can use. For the real Hyperloop, ideally the propulsion system would be built into the track. So probably end up being like a magnetic propulsion system. So you have linear induction motors or something of that sort in the track, and those propel the pod along the track.
I read that you're working on using a cold gas thruster.
We are using a cold gas thruster. Yeah,
that's what you're doing now.
Pretty cool. Yeah.
Have you built something that's cold gas and thrusting?
We're actually in the design phase right now. So we submit our final design package to SpaceX here in the next 2 weeks.
SpaceX is the Elon Musk company.
Yes.
Focused on space, but he's kind of sponsoring this Hyperloop competition.
Yeah, so they run the competition. They built a beautiful long tube for us. It's about 0.8 miles long. I think it's about 70 inches in diameter, if I'm correct on that. But it's amazing. Yeah, to have a facility like that to test your pod on, it's really fun.
How does the cold gas thruster work, basically?
Basically, it's a rocket. It's a rocket.
Is it like sitting in an office chair and squirting a fire extinguisher and rolling across the floor?
That's about it. Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's just conservation of momentum. You shoot mass one way and you go the other way. So in our case, we're shooting out nitrogen out the back of our pod, and that propels us forward.
How fast are you actually going to get a pod to move?
Our goal is actually 200 miles an hour.
Okay.
You're kind of limited by the small length of the tube. To reach super high speeds in that tube, you're going to need extremely high propulsion and braking forces. So high G-forces, something that no human could handle. But our G-forces aren't ridiculously high. But to give you a sense of scale, the team that won last year, the German team from the Technical University of Munich, they reached 200 miles an hour using an electric propulsion system with wheels. So
your cold gas thruster is not actually what would eventually power a Hyperloop?
Probably not.
So why are you, is it just to get people excited? Is this more of a marketing the idea?
A little bit, yeah. It's to get people excited about Hyperloop, thinking about Hyperloop, and as well as to get young engineering students involved in a cool project on working on something that's never been done before.
This sounds like a great thing to study, and we'll learn from it. Are you and I seriously going to rocket to Portland in 15 minutes? Realistically, what are the odds?
I'd say it's probably going to happen. The timeline is the issue for me. I'd say maybe 15, 20 years before something like that happens, just with a giant vacuum tube. We would end up being the largest vacuum chamber in the world, even if you went Seattle to Portland or San Fran to LA. Yeah, that kind of thing is really hard to make, and there's a lot of issues that come up with building a vacuum tube that big, and how do you make it safe? How do you essentially prevent failure? Because failure in a vacuum tube would probably be catastrophic. So there's a lot of engineering challenges with the infrastructure as well, but we specifically work on the pod.
You're working on the pod. What is it like, Mitchell, to work on a project that might be fantastical? It sounds like science fiction. What is it like for you?
It's awesome because I'll go back to competition one. We pushed through all the rigorous testing procedure that SpaceX has for you, and we actually got a test pod in the big tube. And so we got to run down the big tube, and I was part of the manufacturing and the design of the braking system. And so when your pod starts to get up to speed, you get a little scared because you're like, okay, now my braking system really has to work or this thing's going to crash. And everything, even though it was a low speed run, everything worked out perfectly and we were all high fiving, and it was a lot of fun. That was probably my favorite moment of Hyperloop so far. But yeah, hoping to have another few of those in the future.
That's my favorite part of the Hyperloop trip is the brakes. I really want in my 720 mile per hour trip, I'm highly interested in the brakes working well.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
So well done.
Yeah. That's, I mean, the propulsion system's the fun part, the part that makes it go fast. But if the brakes don't work, then you're in trouble. So,
Mitchell Fremont, don't forget to do your actual class study as well, okay?
I'll try.
Okay.
I'll try.
Junior at the University of Washington, studying mechanical engineering, but we met him because he directs the University of Washington's Hyperloop team, trying to get us from, for example, Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes someday.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So as you just heard, Mitchell thinks Hyperloop could happen in 15 or 20 years. Let's talk Hyperloop and other transit futures with Mark Hallenbeck, director of the State Transportation Center at University of Washington. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks. I'm always happy to be here.
What do you think? Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes within 20 years?
No.
No?
No.
How come? This is a hardworking young man. He seems to...
The technology might work. Yeah, you know, there's Hyperloop could come. That part, the technology, it's kind of like automated cars. The technology could very well show up. The real question is the financial side. Does it actually make financial sense to build a 180-mile tube? And where are you going to put the 180-mile tube? So if you look at Elon Musk, his next giant company, a really, really important company, is called the Boring Company. And it's boring because it builds tunneling machines. And so their test right now is in LA. Can they make a tunneling machine that makes the tunnel inexpensive enough that they can get it in to Portland?
Well, then that sounds like it could that so, could yeah, be the answer to the right-of-way thing.
So that's the answer to the right-of-way, but now you're still doing tunneling. So the typical numbers are if it costs X to build something on the ground, it costs 1.5X to put it up in the air, and it costs 2 to 3X in the ground. Mm. And so if you think of high-speed rail as being expensive because you have to buy the right-of-way and build a rail, multiply by 3, okay? Or, oh, golly gee whiz, you only have to multiply by 1.5. So it's the, and can I charge enough for this trip going to Portland to actually recoup the money? That's
but,
what
but
I mean.
But, you know, train tracks at one time seemed impractical and a freeway system. I just interviewed an astronaut, for God's sake, you know, International Space Station. It takes investment, time, commitment, all that. Why couldn't Hyperloop be that kind of project?
Well, Hyperloop could. You gave me a time frame, and I balk at the time frame.
Okay.
I balk at the time frame because you have to line up you have to prove the technology, you have to line up the money, and then you have to build this thing. And you add those together, and my gut reaction is, yeah, 15 years, no chance on Earth. 20, well, you know, maybe. Just because of the level of construction, but you're still a ways off from actually supplying that technology and making sure it works. I mean, it's cool stuff. It's great theoretics. Yeah, can they really do it? And again, the whole safety factor of can you keep a tube in vacuum at, you know, for 180 miles, how do you deal with it? How do you build stations associated with those tubes? There's an awful lot technologically to do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if they prove the technology, yeah, it'll come. The only question is, what's the time frame?
What about a 15-minute ride from Seattle to Portland in an hour? Governor Inslee said last month he's optimistic about a high-speed train to connect. Actually, he was talking about Vancouver, B.C., and Seattle. Mm-hmm. How far along is the high-speed rail project in Washington?
They're looking for money. So
There's
money. It's not that, at least in high-speed rail, you understand basically everything you need to know about it. You know how much it'll cost to build. You know how fast it'll run. You know what the characteristics look like. Their problem really is how do you start and end it in Vancouver, B.C., and Seattle and Portland? Do you build it cheaply and go to Tukwila and somehow connect it to the airport? Do you figure out how to get it into downtown Seattle? So again, this is why Musk has said, oh, I guess I better figure out a cheaper way to do tunneling. Because if you can find a cheap way to do tunneling, you're not spending $2, $3, $4 billion on the tunnel in downtown Seattle.
Yeah.
But now you're doing, you know, again, you got to figure you have to be in tunnel from Everett to Tacoma because there's not much of a place to bring it up. And so those aspects are the detriment. That's what's really limiting high-speed rail because the cost of going in those areas is so high in traditional manner that you're not sure you can make enough money from the system to pay it off.
Okay. And of course, we just had this Amtrak train going too fast, in December, killed three people, 79 miles an hour, 30 mile an hour zone. What safety measures do you think need to be figured out before? What do you think about the Amtrak dilemma? So what's the lesson?
First, high-speed rail is on separated yes. track. They are not allowed to share track with freight trains. They have to be on their own rail for a variety of reasons. So you have to have your own two railroad tracks, one northbound, one southbound, which means you need new space for those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that is the ultimate rule of high-speed rail. It is on grade separated right-of-way. Yeah. I don't have anything that the papers haven't already talked about in terms of the crash. I don't know why, but you actually have to have control of train speeds and make sure that they are for what the track is marked for. So positive train control, that'll help. Got to make sure that technology works and it's in place.
You know, we've been talking about the future of transportation with Mark Hallenbeck from the State Transportation Center. Right? State Transportation. What's it
close
called?
Close enough.
Yeah.
Washington
University State of Washington's. Center. Yes. Matter. Yes. Washington State Transportation Center. And I want to talk about the present day transportation in our cars because the Seattle City Council, the head of the Land Use Planning Zoning Committee, is proposing reducing parking in the city in favor of more transit. Now, this has been talked about a long time, but we have transit coming online. We have ride shares. We have more and more alternatives to parking. Is this, do you think, the time to talk about not forcing new residential buildings to build parking spaces, reducing parking in areas where there's a mass transit option?
So I'm not a person of extremes, so I never like to say no parking, right? I just don't like that because people do bring vehicles to the city.
We're talking about reductions.
Right. So, but on the other hand, a reduction, particularly as you grow activity levels, population, employment, as you grow those, you want the vast, vast, vast majority of all of those new trips to be in something other than an automobile because there's no space for it. So you want to do the things that make that happen. Now, I just spent my pre-Christmas week in Strasbourg, France, and in Colmar, and those are the whole central city of Strasbourg, the only vehicles you see are service vehicles in delivering goods. People walk, they take the trams. The trams work because there's nothing in the way.
How's the weather in the hills in Strasbourg?
It was actually, the weather was Seattle. It was high 30s and drizzling.
Okay.
And people riding bikes all over through the drizzle without wearing good protective rain gear. They were just wearing their normal clothes. I was surprised at that.
Hilly? Flat?
Strasbourg itself is pretty flat. The hills are outside of the city.
Oh.
But again, those things work. You can. There are lots of places in the world that have shown that those things work. But you have to have ways to get people in. You have to have ways to get people out. You have to have ways to get people around. In an area that's lacking in space, then you go to higher capacity, more dense modes of travel. And so that doesn't mean adding car space. That means reducing car space.
We just have a minute left, and you and I were talking before the microphones turned on about the crashes on Seattle streetcars. This woman was killed on Yesler Way, and her brother is suing the city, claiming that the city could have made streetcars safer, should have, and didn't.
I'm not an expert on streetcar wheel design. I can't comment on that and how that does the route. What I can say is the way that Norwegians and most of the Europeans deal with it is they don't ride street bikes. They ride mountain bikes, big, fat, knobby tires.
I didn't know that.
And the big, fat, knobby tires are too big to go into the tracks. So you can still slip on metal, because metal is slick, but you can't actually drop your wheel down into the track. So if you're riding, that's Mark's recommendation to you. If you're going to ride a bike in an area that has streetcar tracks, ride bigger tired bikes.
Okay.
It's so safer.
Some of the other ideas for Seattle have been putting rubber filler in the grooves, choosing a different kind of rail. I guess they could have just excluding bicycles from the streetcar lane. But in the meantime, I got some big fat tires. Use that.
It's a great thing that you can do.
Yes. And we've been talking with Mark Hallenbeck, and he's with the University of Washington's Washington State Transportation Center. Thanks for coming and talking about the future and the now. Thank you.
Always happy to be here.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. That's it for today. Glad you listened with us. The show is put together by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Bon Huberman, Jason Pagano, Jeannie Yandel. I'm Bill Radke, and I hope you'll join us tomorrow as we wrap up the news on the Week in Review.